Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary about the black community. This week, I have a book review from the New York Times, an essay about an upcoming Supreme Court case from the Guardian newspaper, opposing opinion pieces about the legacy of the Million Man March from the websites The Root and Word in Black, and I'm starting with this. NASA astronaut class appears to be the first without black recruits in 40 years. This was written by Elijah Sowers and published October 4th, 2025. This is from the website Mashable.com. When the National Aeronautic and Space Administration announced its 10 newest astronaut trainees during a recent ceremony, the women on the stage outnumbered the men for the first time in the space agency's history. Six of the recruits who will train for future missions to the moon and potentially Mars are female. But with that milestone apparently came another, the first astronaut class in 40 years without any black candidates. The most recent class to not include any black men or women was Group 11 in 1985, NASA's History Office confirmed for Mashable. Since President Donald Trump took office, his administration has ended federal diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility initiatives by executive order, including at the United States Space Agency, calling them illegal and immoral discrimination programs. Within weeks, NASA had closed some offices and removed some content from its website about minorities. At the live-streamed ceremony in Houston on September 22nd, officials emphasized that the latest inductees into astronaut training represented the best and the brightest among 8,000 applicants. "We know that you represent your families, you represent your communities, you represent NASA, which is the most respected and revered agency in the whole world." "No pressure," said Acting Administrator Sean Duffy, who was also Transportation Secretary. "But most importantly, you represent America, the greatest, most innovative, creative country that's ever existed on the face of the earth." Whether the White House's DEI order had any effect on the astronaut selection process is unclear. It's also not known whether the agency remains committed to the goal of including a person of color or in its upcoming Artemis III moon landing crew. NASA spokespeople did not respond directly to written questions from Mashable for this story. Instead, NASA Press Secretary Bethany Stevens provided a statement that only addressed the 2025 astronaut class, suggesting that race and gender were not considerations. NASA, like most parts of the federal government in the mid-20th century, was slow to include black people in roles both inside and outside the spaceship. In the 1950s and 60s, all astronauts were white men. The shift occurred in 1978 when the agency selected 35 pilots and mission specialists for the space shuttle program. According to a NASA feature no longer available on its website, which can be accessed through Internet archives, that class, known as Group 8, included three black recruits. One of them, Guillaume Bluford, became the first black American in space during Challenger's STS-8 mission in 1983. By the mid-1980s, NASA had become more focused on racial and ethnic diversity. It consistently selected at least one black recruit per astronaut class starting in 1987 with Mae Jemison, who became the first black woman in space 5 years later. Hiring of more underrepresented minorities extended to other NASA jobs as well, including research and engineering roles. Up until this year, NASA has emphasized its commitment to putting a woman and person of color on the moon during its Artemis III moon landing mission, which could happen as early as 2027, following Artemis II next year. Representing their diversity of the American public is critical to the future of NASA's human exploration missions, the agency said in a news release in 2021. In a statement to Mashable, NASA Press Secretary Stevens did not address whether NASA still intends to include a person of color in the Artemis III crew, or sentiments concerning the agency's overall views on diversity in the astronaut corps. She spoke only to the latest astronaut class selection process. NASA astronauts are chosen through a rigorous process overseen by an objective selection board based on education, physical fitness, applicable experience, and more, Stevens said. Each astronaut candidate is selected because they are the most qualified and capable to advance NASA's mission, exploring for the benefit of America, unlocking the mysteries of the universe, and inspiring the world. General efforts to increase the representation of people of color in astronomy have existed for many years. The American Astronomical Society released a position paper on the state of the profession in 2010, finding that African American, Hispanic, and Native American individuals remained markedly underrepresented in the field, without a 5- to 10-fold increase in doctoral degrees awarded to these racial and ethnic minorities each year, parity would be decades away, according to the paper. This is demonstrated evidence that STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields benefit from diverse perspectives on problems that require more complex thought process, the authors wrote. This is especially relevant to a field like astronomy, where more and more work is being done collaboratively. In the 2022 NASA documentary, The Color of Space, retired astronaut Joan Higginbotham, who is black, said it's important for people of color to see professionals who look like them in various fields. It shows you right there, the people that are there that you can touch, that you can feel, that you can reach out to, that you can talk to, said Higginbotham, who became an astronaut in 1996 after 9 years as a NASA electrical engineer. If they can do it, then there's a chance for me to do it too. The 2025 astronaut candidates include Ben Bailey, Lauren Edgar, Adam Furman, Cameron Jones, Yuri Kubo, Rebecca Lawler, Annan Menon, Imelda Muller, Aaron Overcash, and Catherine Spies, who are all between the ages of 34 and 43, according to NASA. The new class includes a U.S. Army Chief Warrant Officer, a geologist, and 6 test pilots. Most of the test pilots come from the U.S. Air Force and Navy, with one serving as a test pilot for United Airlines. A NASA spokesperson told the New York Times that Kubo's father was of Japanese heritage, but that she did not know the racial identities of the other astronaut trainees, according to a recent report. Apart from photos, NASA has not released information on the new recruits' racial and ethnic backgrounds in their bios or related materials. Among the new recruits is Edgar, 40, who spent more than 17 years supporting NASA's Mars rovers as a geologist, and Menon, 39, who has already traveled to space on SpaceX's Polaris Dawn mission in 2024. Serving as that commercial mission's medical director, Menon beat her husband, NASA astronaut Anil Menon, to spaceflight. Anil Menon entered astronaut training in 2021 and recently received his first crew assignment for work at the International Space Station in June 2026. The 2025 astronaut class will train for 2 years at NASA's Johnson Space Center before becoming eligible to fly in space. Their education will involve lessons in Russian, geology, survival, and space medicine. The trainees also will perform exercises in high-performance jets and underwater simulations. NASA is gearing up for its second Artemis mission next year, the first with passengers, which will send a crew on a 10-day journey flying by the moon without ever landing on it. Astronauts Victor Glover and Christina Hammett-Koch, assigned to this mission in 2023, will be the first person of color and woman, respectively, to fly on a lunar mission. The crew will also include an international colleague, Jeremy Hansen, who is a Canadian astronaut. Their space flight will set the stage for Artemis III, the first human moon landing since Apollo 17, more than 50 years ago. In a 2023 interview with Mashable, Artemis II commander Reed Weissman said the most exciting aspect of the mission is the people with whom he's going. "Look at my crewmates, Victor, Christina, and Jeremy," Weissman said. "We're a slice of North America, and we're a slice of our planet right now. That is awesome, and I'm incredibly excited to go fly with these heroes." That was the article titled, "NASA Astronaut Class Appears to Be the First Without Black Recruits in 40 Years. It was written by Elijah Sowers and published October 4th, 2025 at the website Mashable.com. Next on today's African American Hour are two opinion pieces with opposing views of the Million Man March. The Million Man March took place in October of 1995. The first opinion piece has a positive view of the Million Man March. It is titled, "The Million Man March Turns 30, Why It Still Matters." This was written by David C. Miller and published October 16, 2025 at the website wordinblack.com. The march stands as both memory and mandate, and its call for atonement, reconciliation, and responsibility remains as urgent as ever. Although 3 decades have passed since the historic October 16, 1995 Million Man March, I have vivid memories of that amazing day on the National Mall. Bill Clinton was the President of the United States, and many in the halls of Congress were nervous about 1 million black men converging on D.C. All the ingredients for a memorable day were present. The weather was beautiful, and the energy was electrifying. Walking through the streets of Washington, D.C., affectionately known as Chocolate City, was exhilarating for so many proud black men of all ages who had crowded metro stations across the city. To add to the millions of black men moving through D.C., hundreds of black women could be seen stopping traffic on D.C. streets holding signs that read, "We love black men," as we made our way to the gathering. Filling the cityscape were the sounds of horns blaring and men in cars, buses, and on foot, who were all excited to make history and reclaim what it meant to be a black man in America. This event was not just a march. It was a momentous occasion that will be forever etched in the annals of American history. It was a powerful display of unity and purpose, inspiring us all to strive for a better future. It was a moment that connected black men to a larger movement. Like many of our ancestors who took the bold and audacious step to attend the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom on August 28, 1963, I stood 10 toes down on the mall. There, acknowledging my shortcomings, I vowed to atone for drinking, smoking, and behaving recklessly. I promised to become a better son, father, husband, and change agent. Raised in West Baltimore, I had already experienced my fair share of traumas and disappointments by the time I was 27. I was fortunate to attend the march with several childhood friends who each harbored their own battle scars, trials, and tribulations. Decades later, while many debate the significance and impact of the march, its influence is ongoing. Thousands of black men returned to their communities, joined organizations, and registered to vote as a direct result of the inspiring messages delivered at the march. Others continue to do life-affirming work in communities motivated by the legacy of the march, ensuring that its impact is felt for generations to come, giving us all hope and inspiration for the future. 30 years later, I still remember the insightful words of 12-year-old Allende Jean-Baptiste. Rosa Parks' uplifting and spiritual message for black men to reclaim our families, and the radical call to action delivered by the Honorable Louis Farrakhan. From blue-collar workers to surgeons, men stood shoulder to shoulder, cheering, laughing, and crying, reimagining black masculinity and harnessing the energy needed to transform black communities. I vividly remember standing next to an older brother with a thick salt and pepper beard that distinguished his age and wisdom. He shared that he had lived a fantastic life, partly due to his thriving dental practice. Then he mentioned attending the march to learn ways to give back to his community by creating a pipeline to recruit, educate, and train black male dentists. Another brother, who was a gangster disciple from the Midwest, attended with his son. The brother had been gangbanging since age 12 and participated in the march to learn strategies to transform the gang culture in his community. Years later, I reconnected with the brother to do some work in Peoria, Illinois, and we recollected the power of the march and collective work needed to improve the lives of young black men. These diverse stories and experiences were a testament to the inclusivity and broad impact of the Million Man March. They showed that the march was not just a gathering of black men, but a coming together of individuals from all walks of life, united in their commitment to change and progress. While I was already engaged in transformational work with black men and boys in Baltimore City, the march served as a catalyst for me to radically redefine my work and expand opportunities for black men and boys who continue to be marginalized and disenfranchised within society. The march symbolized a great awakening and a chance to celebrate the best of black manhood, as well as ways to join forces with like-minded black men to advance work with black men and boys. The energy and unity I witnessed at the march fueled my determination to make a difference. It was a turning point in my life, a moment of personal growth and transformation that filled me with hope and motivation. Today, we still live in two Americas, battling for racial equity and the promises of equal protection under the law. Mass incarceration, community violence, underemployment, homelessness, and police brutality remain polarizing challenges that impact black men and families. The deaths of Trayvon Martin, Sandra Bland, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd are painful and constant reminders of the insidiousness of racism and police brutality. The struggle for racial injustice is ongoing, and the lessons and inspiration from the Million Man March continue to guide our efforts to create a more equitable and just society. We must continue to fight, to speak out, and to work together to bring about the change we want to see. The urgency of these challenges should inspire us to act now, not to wait for another tragedy to spur us into action. As we celebrate the 30th anniversary of the march, we need a continued focus on decreasing violence among black men, greater advocacy around maternal health among black women, programs to assist black men returning to communities after incarceration, and more workforce options for black men. Given the current racial animus and divisiveness present in society, it is important that as black men we remember the original call from the 1995 march: atonement, reconciliation, and responsibility. This call is as relevant today as it was 30 years ago, and it is our collective duty to uphold these principles and work toward a more just and equitable society. That was the opinion piece, "The Million Man March Turns 30, Why It Still Matters." It was written by David C. Miller and published October 16, 2025 at the website wordinblack.com. That website adds a note that reads, "David C. Miller, Ph.D., is co-lead for the Baltimore Rites of Passage Initiative." The next opinion piece has a negative view of the Million Man March. It is titled, "Why the Million Man March Was a Total Failure." This was written by Lawrence Ware and published October 16, 2025 at the website theroot.com. It has been 3 decades since hundreds of thousands of black men gathered in Washington, D.C. at a rally organized by the National African American Leadership Summit, the Nation of Islam, and several black civil rights organizations, including the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Listen, there is something beautiful about black men coming together and committing to do better for our community. The fact that the march, which occurred October 16, 1995, happened at all is worth celebrating. But where is the follow-through? The two biggest goals of the march were political and economic in nature. One of the biggest goals of the march was to push back against President Bill Clinton's disastrous 1994 crime bill. That was made into a law just a year before the march, but it was already beginning to have a disastrous impact on the black community. But things only got worse because of that bill. Incarceration rates for black men significantly increased during the 1990s because of the war on drugs and stricter sentencing laws for drug offenses. To put it bluntly, we were sentenced longer and were thrown in jail at higher rates than every other racial group for similar crimes. By 2000, 9.7% of black males aged 25 to 29 were in prison. That was over 6 times higher than that of white men. It was not until the 2010s that things began to change after mass incarceration and public pressure forced states to take a closer look at the ramifications of how they were implementing Clinton's crime bill. So on that metric, the march was a political failure, but it also failed to achieve its economic goals. Another objective of the Million Man March was to combat the unemployment rates that black men faced. In 1999, unemployment rates for black men was approximately double that of their white counterparts. There were many speeches that day that talked about how there was going to be a focus on black male rates of unemployment and a promise that things would get better. Nothing became of this either. It makes sense that there would not be an immediate change. It would be unreasonable to expect black men's unemployment rates to go up overnight. But in the year 2000, 5 years after the march, the unemployment rate of black men was still double that of white men. And in 2025, 30 years after the march, we are doing a bit better, but not much. The black male unemployment rate is at 6.3% compared to 3.7% for white men. Not double as it had been, but not far from it. So what happened? Why did nothing lasting become of what happened that day? The answer is quite simple. There was no concrete, actionable plan for future action beyond the speeches and pledges. There was also an incredible amount of money collected that had an unclear destination. $1.9 million was raised that day. However, an audit later revealed the event had a debt of about $66,000 due to various unpaid bills and fees. How does that happen? Ultimately, the Million Man March was a wonderful day of solidarity, but it had little lasting impact. It gave black men a sugar high that quickly dissipated. If we are being honest, we must call it what it was, a failure. That was the opinion piece titled, Why the Million Man March Was a Total Failure. It was written by Lawrence Ware and published October 16, 2025 at the website theroot.com. And that was the second of two opinion pieces about the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March. My next reading is a selection from the New York Times Book Review. The title of the book is Black Arms to Hold You Up, A History of Black Resistance, written by Ben Passmore. The title of this New York Times review is In This Graphic History, An Unflinching Look at Black Activism. This was written by Sam Thielman and published October 7th, 2025. So much sneering and posturing passes for radicalism in our uneasy political moment that it's a shock to come across the real thing. But here it is. A thoughtful, funny cartoon history of black activism that sets aside nonviolence. Ben Passmore's Black Arms to Hold You Up, A History of Black Resistance, delights in ambiguity, as you might have already gleaned from its title. Are black folks lifting you, or do black people with guns have you at their mercy? Passmore begins by drawing himself looking at his phone, watching the death of Philando Castile, a black man fatally shot in 2016 by a Minneapolis police officer in front of his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, and her daughter. Reynolds taped the incident on her phone and posted it to Facebook. It was the second police killing of a black man captured on video and circulated on social media that week. As Ben watches Castile die, he sinks deeper into despair. wondering how he can live in a country where so many people seem to want to keep him from doing just that. Some commentators suggested that Castile would still be alive if he hadn't been armed and hadn't frightened the Minneapolis Police Department officer into a tragic mistake. Passmore arrives at a less palatable conclusion. For centuries, authorities, official and unofficial, have killed black people with impunity, and Castile was simply another of them. Countering such pessimism is Ben's father, Ronnie, an older man with white dreadlocks who wears a dashiki and a beret covered in pins and who educates Ben about the long struggle against this impunity. The story of resistance is a rich one, he notes, and its champions have tried black separatism, hippie communes, even campaigns of assassination to carve out a space for themselves. Ben is skeptical. Meanwhile, you're over here looking like you robbed a whole failed bookstore, he tells his dad as Ronnie unpacks a bag of radical literature. Together, the pair follow six activists, beginning in circa 1900 Louisiana with Robert Charles, who was beaten by police officers before he pulled out his revolver and fought back. The ensuing days-long manhunt and gunfight had the police and a white mob of thousands on one side, and on the other side, Charles, who was determined to sell his life as dearly as possible. Passmore's persistent skepticism is refreshing. It's undisputed that the 1985 police bombing of the Move commune in Philadelphia killed five children and six adults and left hundreds homeless. It's also true that Move was rife with cultish internal violence and child abuse for decades. Passmore suggests that if we want to take government anti-radicalism seriously as an infringement on Americans' rights to assemble and speak their minds, I do, and I would say that Passmore certainly does as well, then we have to look with clear eyes at the self-dealing sexism, colorism, and corruption that can aid the infiltration of groups devoted to defending black liberty. Of course, sincere internal disagreement can be a strength as well as a weakness, and the plasticity of Passmore's cartooning gives the book's competing ideologies their own distinct appearances. To introduce the anti-Klan activist Robert F. Williams, there's a virtuosic sequence drawn with the specific fluidity of a racist cartoon from the 1930s. For the story of Assata Shakur, he shifts to an angular, almost cubist style. Every element seems packed with meaning. When guns fire and bombs explode, they do so with the damn, damn. And when police helicopters fly overhead, they go whip, whip, whip. In the book, Passmore's surrogate is in search of a way out of his despair, and the author is not quite willing to give him one, except to suggest that individual liberation might come from further reading. Black Arms to Hold You Up follows a sort of downward spiral as the more militant factions of the 1960s civil rights movement encounter persecution, imprisonment, and death. Sometimes the radicals shoot back, and sometimes infighting devolves into outright gang warfare. One of Passmore's most sympathetic subjects is Sanyika Shakur, no relation to Assata, a former Crip who became involved with black nationalism while in prison. There's no process for getting out of Crippin, he tells Ronnie. I was still in prison, and I still had all the same enemies. The book's subjects have such passion and vision that the persistence of violent oppression seems unbearable. When Passmore arrives at the nadir of his despair, he wonders whether violence is the only answer to violence. Is Robert Charles' bloody demise the best-case scenario? The book closes with the story of Micah Johnson, the Afghan war veteran who killed five Dallas Police Department officers at a rally protesting on Castile's behalf. The police finally killed him with a robot-controlled bomb. Johnson was a murderer who was given an other-than-honorable discharge from the Army for sexual misconduct. Was he also on the right side of history? Passmore declines to answer this question, but he asks it loudly. One image from the book review is a page from the graphic novel that serves as a list of members of more militant factions of the civil rights movement that encountered persecution, imprisonment, and death. Those that died are represented by a skeleton standing in a jail cell door. Those who are still alive are shown as men. The line drawing is set during a prison riot. Also, in this page from the graphic novel, there are three colors: white, black, and red. All the words are in black. All of the men are white. All of the skeletons are red. It starts like this. There are two men talking below a prison scene, a man and a son. In the balloons that represent their conversation, the words are, "We learned how to exploit our own people to come up using the drug game and, in turn, were exploited by America through music, religion, politics, or whatever. Though we lost ourselves outside, inside, revolutionaries still fought against oppression on both sides of the walls. There was the Attica Uprising, San Quentin, Camp Hill, the August Rebellion, and many more. George Jackson and other prisoners of war formed the Black Guerrilla Family as an avenging force for our people inside the walls." The list reads, Herman Wallace, 41 years in solitary, dead in 2013, represented by a skeleton. Robert Hillary King, 29 years in solitary, released in 2001, represented by a man holding a club. Albert Woodfox, 43 years in solitary, died of COVID in 2022, represented as a skeleton walking out of a jail cell. JoJo Bowen, 53 years, represented as a man jumping up and down with a knife in his hand. Russell Maroon Schultz, 22 years in solitary, dead in 2021, represented by a red skeleton inside a jail cell. Jaleel Mutakim, 50 years, represented as a man with a prayer cap holding a stack of books under his arms walking out of a jail cell. Lorenzo Camboa Irvin, 15 years, represented as a man wearing a mustache throwing a Molotov cocktail. Sekou Odinga, 33 years, represented as a skeleton throwing a Molotov cocktail. Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, 27 years, dead in 2011, represented as a skeleton sitting on a stool facing towards the inside of a prison cell. Ashanti Alston, 12 years, released in 1985, represented as a man with an eye patch waving to a crowd. Nuh Washington, 29 years, dead in 2000, represented by a skeleton throwing a thunderbolt. Herman Bell, 40 years, released in 2018, represented as a man kneeling. Rochelle Cinque McGee, 67 years, passed in 2023, represented by a skeleton standing inside the door of a jail cell. Ed Poindexter, 53 years, passed in 2023, represented by a skeleton walking out of a jail cell. Carol Crooks, 12 years, released in 1984, represented as a man walking out of a jail. That was a review of the book, Black Arms to Hold You Up, A History of Black Resistance, written by Ben Passmore, published by Pantheon. The title of this book review from the New York Times is titled, In This Graphic History, An Unflinching Look at Black Activism. The review was written by Sam Thielman and published October 7th, 2025. My final reading is an essay about a case coming before the United States Supreme Court from the Guardian newspaper and its theguardian.com website. The title is, A 160-year-old campaign against civil rights heads to the Supreme Court. This was written by Leah Littman and published September 28, 2025. The subtitle to the story is, Louisiana versus Calais could roll back what remains of the Voting Rights Act, putting the future of America's multiracial democracy at stake. With so many things happening everywhere all at once, the start of a new Supreme Court term on October 6th may be flying under the radar. It shouldn't. The state of checks and balances in the country is among the more ominous indicators of the health of America's democracy. In the executive branch is a president who is keen on exercising every lever of power that he has, as well as some he does not, to enrich himself and his allies to suppress dissent and political opposition. The legislature is dominated by a regime-friendly political party that is too happy to roll over and accede to the president's wishes, repeatedly failing to exercise the congressional powers that could rein in the executive branch. Because the executive and legislature branches seem to have jumped the constitutional shark, some people continue to hold out hope that the judicial branch, with the Supreme Court at its apex, will offer a way out of this mess. This would be a mistake. Like Congress, the Republican majority on the Supreme Court has lined up behind one of the president's sweeping assertions of novel powers. The Supreme Court has blocked lower federal court rulings that had reined in the president's authority to withhold federal medical research grants for ideological reasons. It has allowed the executive branch to deploy roving immigration patrols to engage in racial profiling, to expel non-citizens to countries on the brink of civil wars where they could face torture, trafficking, or death, to fire non-regime-friendly officials in violation of federal law, to dismantle entire departments, and more. But one specific case on the court's docket for this term illustrates its role in a more far-reaching right-wing project that goes back all the way to the end of the Civil War. Louisiana versus Calais, capital C-A-L-L-A-I-S, is a major challenge to what remains of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and could radically rework the structure of political representation in the United States. A successful challenge to the Voting Rights Act would allow the Republican Party to further cheat democracy by engaging in even more partisan gerrymandering and erasing several legislative districts held by Democratic officials, many of whom are racial minorities. Calais arises out of the 2020 redistricting process, when Louisiana, like other states, drew new congressional maps. The resulting maps gave black voters fewer opportunities to elect the candidates of their choice than white voters, significantly diluting their voting power. Louisiana has 6 congressional representatives in a state that is about 1/3 black, but drew maps that allow black voters to select only 1/6 of the state's representatives. Lower courts concluded the maps violated 2 sections of the Voting Rights Act, passed during the Civil Rights Movement to address a long history of disenfranchisement. The Voting Rights Act prohibits voting policies that have the effect of disadvantaging black voters, including in electoral representation. In response to these judicial decisions, the Louisiana legislature took another crack at maps that accomplished its partisan objectives, such as preserving Republican Speaker of the House Mike Johnson's seat, while also affording black voters political opportunities. A group of white voters challenged those maps as unconstitutional racial discrimination. Their theory was that the legislature, by trying to ensure both black voters and white voters were represented, had somehow discriminated against white voters. The case is even bigger than a fight about the future of the Voting Rights Act. It is also bigger than the Republican Party's decades-long campaign against the Voting Rights Act. The case is part of a broad effort to not only reinterpret the Reconstruction Amendments, the constitutional amendments passed after the Civil War to ensure equal rights and due process, but also to weaponize them against democracy and civil rights. That conflict is being waged in both the Supreme Court and the White House, and its roots go back more than a century to the aftermath of the Civil War. The big picture helps to underscore what is at stake: the future of the United States as a multiracial democracy. The story of Louisiana versus Calais begins with the project of Reconstruction, the effort to reconstitute the United States after the Civil War and the end of slavery. Reconstruction was an ambitious undertaking that sought to integrate Black Americans into the polity and to protect their rights against the states and political movements that already wanted to claw them back on the heels of the Civil War. Part of this era entailed the passage and ratification of the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that outlawed slavery, guaranteed equal protection, and prohibited racial discrimination in voting, among other things. The people who drafted the 15th Amendment saw the measure as a way to allow Black voters to choose from among his fellow citizens the man who suits him for his representative, as Senator John F. Edmonds put it in 1869. As Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson detailed in an oral argument a few years ago, a report submitted by a congressional committee on Reconstruction said that the entire point of the project was to secure rights for formerly enslaved people. The legislature who introduced the 14th Amendment said, unless the Constitution should restrain them, those states will all, I fear, keep up this discrimination and crush to death the hated freedmen, Jackson said. Reconstruction was an ambitious project that produced real gains. Within a few years, former Confederate states sent Black representatives and senators to Congress and elected Black leaders to state political offices. The federal military conducted voter registration drives in the South. Through Freedmen's Bureau offices, the federal government helped set up thousands of schools that educated hundreds of thousands of children who had been enslaved. In part because of these successes, Reconstruction encountered resistance that became violent. That included the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, which enforced racial hierarchy through a campaign of terror. The many varied opponents of Reconstruction channeled several talking points. One was the idea that the very project of Reconstruction was too radical and had to be limited so as to preserve a pre-existing constitutional order of white supremacy that Reconstruction had sought to remake. The anti-Reconstruction movement scored important victories with Supreme Court decisions from the late 1800s that narrowly interpreted provisions in the 14th Amendment and weakened the federal government's oversight of states' regulation of elections. Another anti-Reconstruction trope was the notion that federal civil rights protections were no longer needed since slavery was a thing of the past. And this line of argument continued. Because federal protections for Black freedmen were unnecessary, retaining their protections was actually unfair to the people who were prohibited from disenfranchising or discriminating against them. Along these lines, when Andrew Johnson vetoed a congressional statute, he insisted that since slavery had been abrogated, federal protections for freedmen therefore operated in favor of the colored and against the white race. When the Supreme Court invalidated the Reconstruction-era Civil Rights Act in 1883, it, too, insisted that the time for federal civil rights protections for freedmen was up, since there must be some stage in the progress of freedmen's elevation when he takes the rank of a mere citizen and ceases to be the special favorite of the laws. This was less than two decades after the end of the Civil War. In short, opponents of Reconstruction tried to weaponize the principles of Reconstruction against it. Southern sympathizers maintained that prohibiting former Confederate states and Confederates from discriminating against black Americans was itself a kind of discrimination. Discrimination against the Confederate states and would-be discriminators. This logic has endured. Decades later, white business owners even challenged the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibits businesses from engaging in racial discrimination as a violation of the 13th Amendment, which prohibits slavery and involuntary servitude. Civil rights organizers and leaders continue to press forward the vision that Reconstruction offered. The 1965 Voting Rights Act was a milestone in their efforts. The Voting Rights Act had two main elements. Section 2 prohibited voting discrimination on a nationwide basis. The other, Section 5, required certain jurisdictions with especially bad histories of voting discrimination to get federal permission before changing their voting laws or policies. The latter system was known as preclearance. The Voting Rights Act had barely become law before the modern Republican Party decided to attack the statute and to specifically use the federal courts to do so. President Richard Nixon opposed renewing the preclearance process. Members of his administration referred to it as punitive legislation, arguing, essentially, that it was unfair to and discriminated against the former Confederate states. Nixon reportedly promised to appoint Supreme Court justices who would not make the South a whipping boy, of all things, on civil rights. To the Supreme Court, he appointed a Southerner, Lewis Powell, who would later warn the expansive interpretations of the Voting Rights Act would turn America's cities into jungles. Nixon also appointed William Rehnquist, who was accused of challenging black and Latino men's voting credentials during elections. Rehnquist denied doing so. Later Republican administrations continued the fight against the Voting Rights Act. Ronald Reagan also opposed renewing the law, referring to it as vindictive, selective, and humiliatory to the poor former Confederacy. His assistant attorney general called the Voting Rights Act protections against voting discrimination a kind of government-imposed discrimination. Again, the same refrain, anti-discrimination is the new discrimination. His administration produced a legal document warning that expansive interpretations of the Reconstruction Amendments, which allowed Congress to adopt expansive civil rights protections, had extreme consequences and must be rejected. The Reagan administration hired a young Samuel Alito after he professed interest in apportionment, or how legislatures draw districts. The administration also hired a young John Roberts, who helped the administration's unsuccessful effort to support renewing and expanding the Voting Rights Act. Both men are now poised to decide whether Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act can limit how states apportion representation. This effort to weaponize the principles of equality against it would return with Bush versus Gore. The case that halted Florida's efforts to accurately count the votes in the 2000 presidential election and in the process handed the presidency to George W. Bush. Bush's litigation team argued that manually recounting votes in the jurisdictions affected by lingering uncertainty resulting from machine tabulation was a denial of equal protection. Their argument was that manually recounting ballots only in those areas affected by tabulation uncertainties was unequal. In other words, equal protection required potentially disenfranchising voters in the affected areas, which had comparatively large groups of minority voters. The lawyers who pressed this theory included Roberts, Amy Barrett, and Brett Kavanaugh, all of whom now sit on the Supreme Court. The Trump administration has picked up these ideas and pushed them to further extremes. In an array of executive orders and guidance letters, the administration has insisted that civil rights laws actually prohibit measures that are designed to achieve equality. It has invoked federal civil rights laws that prohibit discrimination to insist that schools must discriminate against certain speech. It has decided that federal anti-discrimination law bars efforts designed to achieve diverse schools and businesses. It has argued that federal anti-discrimination measures, actually requires some discrimination against some disfavored groups. The Roberts Court has channeled these same ideas into its decisions. It was unfair and unequal to punish the South, Roberts wrote for the Republican justices who invalidated the free clearance process in 2013. That system was too extreme in giving the federal government that kind of control over elections, he added. True equality, the Roberts Court has ruled, actually requires a prohibition on schools trying to achieve diverse student bodies by considering applicants' race. The time for schools' race-conscious measures designed to achieve racial diversity and representation is over, according to this court. So too is the time for protecting the rights of minority voters, the court said, when it invalidated the Voting Rights Act pre-clearance system in 2013. Pre-clearance was no longer necessary, the court said, because Section 2's nationwide ban on voting discrimination could do all the work. But the court has decided to consider whether Section 2's time is up as well. In 2023, Kavanaugh openly stated that Congress's authority to authorize race-based redistricting cannot extend indefinitely into the future. He was referring to the Voting Rights Act requirements that legislatures ensure black voters are represented, not to legislatures' frequent practice of ensuring only white voters are represented. The latter is apparently neutral and fine, whereas the former is seen as suspect. No wonder Justice Elena Kagan remarked in an oral argument that, in recent years, the Voting Rights Act has fared not well in this court. Which brings us to Louisiana versus Calais. Multiple courts relied on Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act to strike down a set of legislative maps that did not afford black voters with equal rights or equal opportunities as white voters. That set off a redistricting process where the Louisiana legislature had to ensure the state's maps provided black voters with political representation. Now the Supreme Court is being asked to find Section 2 illegal, to say that considering political equality is a kind of discrimination. The argument is that prohibiting legislatures from discriminating against black voters by denying them political opportunities actually discriminates against white voters. Calais is emblematic of several themes that have defined the work of the Roberts Court to date and that the court will expand upon still. Front and center is the notion of conservative grievance, the idea that Republican constituencies are the real victims of subordination today, their power diminished by pluralism, modernity, civil rights, democracy, you name it. Conservative grievance imagines that there is no discrimination except for discrimination against white Christian conservatives and the super rich. That's not reality, as there is no evidence of widespread discrimination against white people. The conservative grievance mindset insists that the Constitution and civil rights laws protect social and religious conservatives' prejudices. The idea is that if you squint hard enough, it turns out that civil rights protections actually prohibit measures that are designed to secure civil rights. The court has played a pivotal role in the right-wing project translating these grievances into a redesign of American law and politics. The reality of the court's shadow docket, the set of orders and decisions the court issues without full briefing, oral argument, advance notice, and often on an emergency basis, is that we do not know which other matters will make their way up to the court over the next year. The shadow docket is one of the primary vehicles the court has used to weigh in on much of the litigation concerning the Trump administration, and specifically to block lower court rulings and greenlight many of the administration's claims of new sweeping presidential authority. In the last 3 months alone, the shadow docket is where the court allowed the administration to continue to withhold almost $800 million in medical research grants, to fire officials in violation of federal law, to take steps to dismantle the Department of Education, to have roving immigration patrols engage in racial profiling, and more. In one of the many cases where the court's Republican appointees voted in favor of the Trump administration on the shadow docket, Justice Jackson wrote, "What the Supreme Court is doing is Calvin Ball, but with a twist. In Calvin Ball, the fictional game played in the Calvin and Hobbes comics, there are no rules. Only, there is one rule. This administration always wins, Jackson quipped. But the Supreme Court's governing rule may be a little broader and even more terrifying than that. The Republican justices seem to think that not only are Republicans entitled to power, they are also entitled to use that power to do whatever they want. That is why the court treats it as an emergency when a federal court blocks a Trump administration policy. That is also why the court seems to look at the Voting Rights Act prohibitions on racial discrimination as illegitimate. This is also another iteration of the Republican justices' refrain that the Constitution is colorblind, that it does not permit officials to take race into account for any reason. The theory is a work of historical fiction, as Jackson illustrated by pointedly quoting from Congress's report on Reconstruction. Reconstructionist lawmakers argued that the Reconstruction amendments authorized measures that would benefit black Americans, rectify discrimination against them, and prevent future discrimination as well. Moreover, the colorblind theory has been somewhat less than colorblind in practice. In the context of the voting rights case, for example, colorblind constitutionalism would permit legislatures to redistrict in ways that result in white voters being overrepresented, but would prohibit laws from requiring legislatures to ensure that black voters are represented as well. That is not being colorblind, it is racial hierarchy. In the recent past, colorblind constitutionalism has led the court to say that colleges considering race as one factor in an applicant's file to ensure colleges are diverse is unconstitutional. But immigration officers considering race as one factor in who to detain and deport is perfectly legal. So-called colorblind constitutionalism has always been a tool to reinforce Republicans' power. A century ago, it was a way of resurrecting the Confederacy and dismantling Reconstruction, so it could pave the way for the end of the law that made the United States a multiracial democracy. That was the essay titled, A 160-Year-Old Campaign Against Civil Rights Heads to the Supreme Court. It was written by Leah Littman and published in the Guardian newspaper on September 28, 2025. The Guardian also adds that Leah Littman is a professor of law at the University of Michigan. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcast or in the Audio Reader archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.